Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Frank Wilczek. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004. He is the Herman Feshbach Professor of Physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, founding director of the Sung Dao Lee Institute, and chief scientist at the Wilczek Quantum Center in Shanghai, China, and a distinguished professor at Arizona State University and Stockholm University. We're talking about his new book, Fundamentals, 10 Keys to Reality. Professor Wilczek, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here, so to speak. I'm actually in Concord, Massachusetts.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Did you get a lot of snow?
Quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, I think we got less than you for the first time in the history of winter, because Worcester...
It's very beautiful.
Yeah. This is a fascinating book. You want to convey the central messages of modern physics as simply as possible. I want to say for the benefit of the audience, there is no mathematics in this book. Virtually.
Very, very little.
Very, very. How did you manage that? That must have been a struggle.
Well, it's a discipline that I've come to really enjoy, which is to convey ideas in different forms while still doing them justice as best one can. And it forces me to reimagine the meaning of the equations and express them in terms that people who are not trained in mathematics can appreciate. So I think of metaphors. I sort of think of myself as a particle or a field doing things and go through the muscular motions and make analogies. And, you know, so this is something that it helps me in my work, actually, is to try to imagine myself as a different kind of physical object, as a Higgs boson or as a neutrino.
Wow.
And experience the world the way they do. Yeah.
Now, you're right that this book changed your perception of the world. Explain that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I got to thinking very much about fundamentals, which is what I wanted to convey, the fundamentals, not only of physics, but of science as a whole, that are relevant to curiosity about reality, to the kinds of questions that philosophers and theologians tackle. And what we found in our accurate sort of critical examination of reality that we call science is that it's amazing that the world is amazingly comprehensible in its operating system, so to speak, in the most basic principles and laws, but the way those unfold can be very, very complex. And relating the fundamentals to everyday experience is a great challenge. So that's what I had to face, as we mentioned, conveying the mathematics in more everyday terms, and really coming to understand that a deeper realization of the nature of the problem we face. I don't think it's a completed project on the scientific side to explain everyday reality. I think we have a pretty good understanding of the most basic interactions, but to climb back from there to what I call it, finding myself in the equations, to recognizing the experience of the world that I actually have, is still a work in progress. It's a defined mind, defined understanding of the tangible realities we see and how we manage to process them into conscious experience.
One of the overarching themes of the book, I found this really interesting, is abundance. There's a lot of space and time.
There's a lot of space and time.
There's a lot of it.
And most educated people these days are familiar with the idea that the universe is very, very big and very, very old compared to a human lifetime or a human size. But less familiar, perhaps, is the idea of inner abundance.
That's right.
Which is that we, although we're small compared to the universe, we're very large compared to units that can do significant information processing and underlie things we call mind, or for that matter, physiology, metabolism, and so forth. One of the things I'm proudest of in the book is I tried to quantify how many thoughts we can have in a lifetime. So to quantify that idea of inner abundance also in time, that although in some sense life is short compared to the lifetime of the universe, an individual human life is very short, but if you count how many thoughts we can have, it's many billions. So there is a kind of inner abundance too.
One of the other overarching themes, and it's interesting to read this phrase, to appreciate the physical universe properly, one must be born again. And that sounds very religious.
It is, kind of, but it's not characteristic of any accepted religious denomination that I know of. But I guess I'm founding my own religion here. But while I was writing the book, my new grandson was starting to turn from a baby into a functioning human.
I'm a grandparent too, and that's a fascinating time period.
It's a very fascinating project to watch, a process to watch, because they have to understand the most basic things about how to organize their perceptions of the world, that there are regularities and the behavior of things, that, you know, the electrical impulses that are arriving at the back of their retina, all jumbled up on a two-dimensional screen, can be interpreted as a three-dimensional world that you can walk around in, and so forth. This has to be learned. And babies, of course, are not critical thinkers, and also they don't have access to telescopes or microscopes or spectrometers or magnetometers or so any of the things we've used to construct our most accurate models of the world. And so the rules that they construct unconsciously, we all construct to get around in the world, rules of thumb, turn out to be quite different from the organization that does most justice to really accurate understanding of reality and critical thinking. And to get to the latter, you not only have to learn some very unfamiliar things, you have to unlearn some things. The world is quite different. And that's why I call it being born again, because you have to leave off your preconceptions and be open to new ways of imagining what reality is.
I think that's the general public has a lot of problem with quantum mechanics because it seems counterintuitive or counter of what we learned about the world as we evolved from a baby.
It's not
visible. We can't taste it or touch it.
Right.
But those are the laws of the universe.
Those are the laws of the universe. And you can't taste it or touch it, but you can
use it.
You can benefit from the experience of earlier explorers, and you can it's very powerfully used. We wouldn't be able to talk the way we are with each other right now, nor would your listeners be able to hear us if not for quantum mechanics, which underlies all of modern electronics. So it's very powerful. It works. And you can get familiar with it by playing around, understanding how transistors work and iPhones work. I mean, you can go as deep as you want, but the most basic processes require a lot of imagination and sort of require, as I said, unlearning. But they're not extremely complicated. It's like a simple text, but written in a very unfamiliar language.
Right, right.
So you need an interpreter to get there.
You love to make lists, because there's a lot of lists in this book, but I want to start with the first list that you come across, the four deceptively easy principles, and I want to talk about each of them in turn.
Okay.
The first one is the basic laws describe change. Elaborate on that.
Well, this probably was Isaac Newton's greatest discovery, which is that the basic laws of physics the ones that are simple, that we can capture and that are regular, that don't change as a in space and don't change in time, so the universal laws, are laws that tell you if you have a description of the situation, of the physical situation, at one time, then the equations will tell you what it's going to be at the next time. That's what turns out to be simple. Whereas, say, for instance, many religious views of the world have the world evolving towards a given end, and you can only understand what's going to happen by understanding what the end is going to be. Or you find laws that are different. Well, we'll come to that. But yes. But what turns out to be simple is and universal is the laws that tell you how things change. That wasn't exactly obvious. Now
your number two, the basic laws are universal. That means from end to end, wherever you are, wherever you go, whatever time, the laws remain the same. Is there no feeling that maybe there might be some strange part of the universe, maybe out towards the edge where things get a little weird and we're not?
We haven't seen it.
Okay, so as far as we know.
We haven't seen anything like that, but yes, it's not a completely heretical speculation that could be the case.
Okay.
At different levels of what you mean by different laws. It could be that the laws are tweaked in different ways,
right,
that they have a family resemblance to the laws we know, but maybe with different strengths of the different interactions, things like that. But there could be drastic differences. The dimension of space could be different, for instance, sufficiently far away. As far as we know, and this is based on a tremendous amount of experience and data in measuring the properties of distant stars and galaxies, they're distant not only in space, but also because of the finite speed of light, it turns out that they can be distant in time. Mm. And we can see that the kind of patterns of light that different atoms emit that are reproducible, that the same kind of atoms exist. So there's a lot of evidence that the same laws hold everywhere.
The basic laws are also local, and this brings up the idea of locality. And I need you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, this is a more subtle idea. But basically, it's that you can predict what's going to happen next, which is the first characteristic of the laws, which is what you want to do. You can predict what's going to happen next here in terms of what's going on just in my immediate neighborhood. You don't have to know what's going on. You don't have to have independent information, independent sources of information about what's going on far away. So I guess one tangible way to think about that is that all information is propagated at fastest at the speed of light. So if something happens far away, it creates a disturbance that propagates towards us at the speed of light. It could be a disturbance in a gravitational field or a disturbance or an electromagnetic radiation comes toward us, and it doesn't affect us until it's upon us. It takes the speed. So the laws turn out it can be formulated in terms of disturbances that propagate through space, so-called fields, where nothing changes faster than the speed of light, and you can determine what's going to happen next here in terms of just what's happening in our immediate neighborhood if you measure things sufficiently accurately.
Now, these four, again, deceptively easy principles are a big thing. The fact that we found those out, that we discovered.
That the laws are precise.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. This is, for instance, where Plato would have jumped ship. Plato thought that the physical world is kind of an imperfect copy of an ideal world, and so you
the shadow on the wall of the cave.
Right.
You
shouldn't be surprised that the laws aren't always the same. That they're kind of they wear down with time. Maybe they have exceptions, things like that. And above all, that what happened in the development of our understanding of fundamentals is that we've gradually raised the standards of what we mean by understanding something.
Right.
Now, we want to have precise, quantitative descriptions of controlled experiments, and we're not satisfied with anything less. So we work very, very hard. And people, in fact, are incented, experimenters are have a high incentive to try to find exceptions. That's the kind of thing they get Nobel Prizes for, if they can break the laws. So people work very hard to make the laws accurate and a full description of basic observations.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Frank Wilczek. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004. He is the Hermann Feschbeck Professor of Physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, founding director of the Sungdao Li Institute, and chief scientist at the Wilczek Quantum Center in Shanghai, China, and a distinguished professor at Arizona State University and Stockholm University. And we're talking about his book, and I think it's really a brilliant, pretty brilliant book, Fundamentals, 10 Keys to Reality. The great thing about this book, Professor Wilczek, is that it has a flow to it. In other words, you really can't just sort of dip into it. You need to get sort of experience the flow of your ideas till you get to the end.
Well, I don't want to make it seem too intimidating.
No. I'm saying that makes it easier to understand.
Yeah, it has a structure to it, and that's, I think that's correct. If I may recommend the way of reading it, is to first read the whole thing. Don't insist on understanding every word necessarily, although I hope you will. But it's not that long for the amount of territory it covers. And the later insights inform the earlier ones in ways. So I think a second reading makes it an even richer experience. And one of my good friends compared it to a book of hours.
Yes.
Which is a concept I had never heard of, but I wasn't familiar with. But it's something that you can look into for inspiration at different times, read little bits of it, and be reminded of important ideas. So the organization in terms of 10 basic assertions or 10 keys to reality, I think really is meant to be an aid to memory and an aid to imagination, so you can get a real comprehension of the whole thing if you just remember that list and call to mind what it means. That I was originally inspired by the Ten Commandments, which have been very successful.
And there's only 10 of them. There's only 10 of them. So you wanted to get it down to a tight list.
And the list of 10 that appears at the end of all the dummy books. So it's a very good structure. And I put a lot of thought into the 10 that I settled on. And there are sharp assertions like there's plenty of space, there's plenty of time. And finally, complementarity is mind expanding. So each is a very pithy assertion about reality that is true and deeply meaningful.
And there's also a lot of personal anecdotes in this book. And there's one I found really funny about the axions.
Yeah.
You named it after a laundry detergent?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I had been home from college, if I remember correctly. I didn't know this would become so important, so I didn't record the details. But I was shopping with my mother. She liked to have me around on her grocery shopping expeditions, and I noticed this product on the shelf. This is a dishwasher soap called Axion. And I thought that really sounded like a particle. And I was kind of flirting with physics at the time. And I said, gosh, if I ever had a chance to name a particle, that really is a great name, and it deserves to be used. And eventually I got the chance that we had this particle that solved an important problem in fundamental physics that was connected with an axial current, so I could sneak the name in. Now I think I and many otherwise rational, otherwise respectable physicists think that it's quite likely that this axion particle not only exists, but supplies the dark matter of the universe. So,
I know. And I don't think the laundry detergent exists anymore.
It does in Europe, actually.
Oh, it does.
Do a Google search and see that. I don't think it is in the States, but it's certainly you can find it in the world.
No, we only have a few, like 5 minutes left, and I can't do this book justice in a half hour. But I want to ask you about one thing that just sort of made me stop in my tracks while I was reading it. You said, you were writing about how complexity emerges fundamentally. How do we get complexity? And you talk about 16 words, and you have 16 words for an algorithm for producing the complete works of Shakespeare. One, choose an ASC II character, a letter, a number.
ASCII
at random. Record it and repeat, and complexity will emerge. Elaborate on that, because you didn't spend enough time on that.
Well, if you just produce random strings of characters and produce enough of them, eventually, by chance, you'll produce the works of Shakespeare and everything else. It's a finite probability with each try that you'll produce that particular combination. And since by hypothesis you're going on forever, any finite probability will actually be realized.
That's amazing.
So that's just a little theorem that you will, in this way, produce the works of Shakespeare. I think I also mentioned the paper that will win the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2025, and some other the history of England. Anyway, and that's true. Of course, that's a bit of a cheat, because the hard part is finding those texts in this vast mound of nonsense that will actually be printed out. So it's not a practical way of producing the works of Shakespeare.
But
it shows in principle how a simple operating system, a very, very simple mathematical procedure, if you like, that you can describe very explicitly that a computer could do, is adequate to producing vast amounts of complexity. And if you sort of add ideas about evolution, which sculpts and throws away the bad parts, you're started towards an explanation of how a complex world can emerge from
right.
very simple in beginning described by the Big Bang, and a very simple operating system of laws that we've established.
Complementarity is a major idea and concept in this book. The one that you described is mind expanding. I lived through the 60s, so that immediately reminded me of LSD. But it's about dualities in quantum mechanics, but also dualities in our life. And you tie it all together and make it very human in the last chapters of the book. Talk to me about complementarity as a fundamental principle.
Right. As we discussed, I was very interested. I was very determined to get 10 keys to reality.
Yep.
So I made a list, which was originally, if I remember correctly, 17. I culled the list, but not down to 10. I culled it down to 9, because I wanted to reserve one for an overarching principle, which kind of emerges as wisdom from all the rest, and that was complementarity. Complementarity is the concept that different kinds of descriptions of the same thing can be valid, even though they're stated in languages that are kind of difficult to translate or maybe impossible to translate from one to the other. And each of them is valid in its own terms, and each of them is useful in answering different kinds of questions about your object, your system, your whatever. So this is an invitation to think different, to perceive reality in different ways. And it's absolutely required if you're going to understand quantum mechanics. This was Niels Bohr's great insight. At first, I didn't like complementarity, and I don't think Einstein liked it either, because there's the idea would be that there would be one correct way to understand things and no other way. Every other way is inferior. But as I've gotten older and wiser, I've come to appreciate Bohr's attitude, which is that is this complementarity, that different ways of thinking about things can be extremely fruitful and valid on their own terms, with even though they're sort of mutually incomprehensible.
But it's so necessary that both of those sides exist simultaneously.
Well, it's difficult to apply both of them simultaneously. Difficult or impossible.
But they do exist simultaneously.
Yes. So a good example, I think, that's led to endless philosophical debates that go endlessly around in circles is this question of free will versus determinism.
Right.
We all experience free will, or at least I do, and I assume from what I observe of other people who seem to be broadly similar, that we experience the making choices, and our legal system is based on the concept that people make choices and have agency, and our moral system. So when discussing those kinds of questions, legal and moral questions, and in predicting how people are going to behave as sort of macroscopic players in the world, it's a very useful and, in fact, I think, indispensable concept. On the other hand, we have the physical description of matter, in which free will has not turned out to be a useful concept so far, where the equations are perfectly definite and don't seem to have any element of choice, really. And I think there's overwhelming evidence for the proposition that mind emerges from matter, that human minds are based on human brains, so it's really an emergent property of matter itself. And so we have two very different descriptions, one in which free will plays a very central role, another in which free will plays no role at all, except as a challenge to understand how you could possibly have this.
We're completely out of time. We're literally over. I want to end with just a short sentence from your book. Science does not exhaust beauty. I think that's a beautiful sentence
right there.
Science
does not exhaust beauty, right? But it provides plenty, but it doesn't exhaust.
My guest tonight has been Frank Wilczek. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004. He's the Hermann Feschbeck Professor of Physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, founding director of the Tseng Dao Li Institute, and chief scientist at the Wilczek Quantum Center in Shanghai, China, and a distinguished professor at Arizona State University and Stockholm University. And we've been talking about his book. We have barely scratched the surface of it. There's a lot in here, and it's a good read. It's a good read. It's a trip. Fundamentals, 10 Keys to Reality. Thank you so much for your time, Frank.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.